is the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you on this beautiful Wednesday in Washington, D.C. And Senator Sanders had an interesting moment on the floor of the Senate yesterday. And after we got off the air yesterday, Fox last night released, Fox so-called news, released the names of the 10 contestants, the 10 Republicans who are going to be actually on the floor, right? Or in the big kids' room, as opposed to the children's. Remember family dinners? Like, maybe you haven't had that experience, but I back when I was a little kid, when our family would get together and there'd be a whole bunch of people, it'd be all the adults at one table and all the kids at another table. Well, that's kind of how they're organizing it over at Fox so-called news for the so-called debates tomorrow. The head of the RNC, this according to Reuters, the head of the Republican Party on Wednesday said its presidential candidates are unlikely to attack each other in the party's first official debate, but instead are focused on ousting Democrats from the White House. In other words, we're going to attack Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. It'll be interesting to see if they try to attack Bernie Sanders, other than name calling. I mean, you can kind of depend on the name calling. Oh, he's a socialist. But will they actually say, oh, my God, Bernie Sanders wants to strengthen Social Security? Bernie Sanders wants to strengthen Medicare? Bernie Sanders wants to raise the minimum wage? Bernie Sanders wants to strengthen the ability of workers to unionize? Do you think that they're going to say this would not make a drinking game, right? Because it ain't going to happen. But they will be attacking Hillary Clinton, and it will be with the old Fox tropes. You know, oh, she was part of the administration that had the so-called IRS scandal. She beat up Benghazi. Oh, man, it's incredible. I mean, it's really in a way somewhere between bizarre and tragic. So all of that said, let me share with you. I said Bernie had a really cool moment yesterday on the floor of the United States Senate. And the part about it that I thought was coolest was that he mentioned my show. But we will get to that. Here is the first point that he makes, the first clip of this, number one. How Citizens United has, in other words, the Supreme Court. I keep saying this. We no longer have a democracy in this country. We have, basically a constitutional monarchy, and the monarchs are the nine justices on the Supreme Court, and the five right wingers are the ones who have been calling the tune for years. I mean, they put George Bush into office, for God's sake, and so they're the monarchs. And what the monarchs decided is that rather than having a democratically elected representative republic, they're constitutionally limited representative democratic republic. Instead of having that, we're going to have an oligarchy. That's the essence of Citizens United. And here's Senator Sanders talking about that on the floor of the Senate yesterday.
As a result of Citizens United, billions of dollars from the wealthiest people in this country will, during this campaign cycle, flood the political process. Super PACs, a direct outgrowth of the Citizens United decision, enable the wealthiest people and the largest corporations to contribute unlimited amounts of money into campaigns. According to recent FEC filings, super PACs have raised more than $300 million for the 2016 presidential election already, and this election cycle has barely begun.
All right. And meanwhile, we've got these Republicans. We played these clips yesterday, I believe it was, the day before yesterday. Wasn't it Tuesday? Yeah, Monday, yesterday. Okay, yeah, I don't do time. This is who was probably the most egregious in this. It was probably Scott Walker. Yeah, let's go to Scott Walker, clip number 14, Shano. This Because Citizens United is allowing the Koch brothers to prop up Scott Walker, to get him elected governor of Wisconsin, to keep him elected governor of Wisconsin, to get him reelected governor of Wisconsin, to pack the Wisconsin Supreme Court so the corruption investigation into Scott Walker can be set aside by the Wisconsin Supreme Court. The special prosecutor, by the way, is now challenging that in Wisconsin and is probably going to kick this thing to the U.S. Supreme Court. And, you know, we'll see where that goes. But anyhow, here's Scott Walker day before yesterday.
Well, first off, it's not the clean power plan. It's the costly power plan. It would be like a buzzsaw to the nation's economy. The states like mine and many of the other governors here would be devastated by that. You know, I'm an Eagle Scout. We were taught a long time ago your campsite should be cleaner when you leave than when you find it. So I want to balance a sustainable environment with a sustainable economy.
Right. In other words, you know, don't make life difficult for the billionaires. Don't make them put scrubbers on their smokestacks. God forbid. Carly Fiorina, kind of the same thing. You know, she, instead of going after the fossil, you know, instead of shilling for the fossil fuel billionaires, Carly Fiorina is shilling for the bankster billionaires. But this is another, you know, candidate brought to you by Citizens United. Here's what she had to say.
Democrats passed Dodd-Frank. Dodd-Frank has caused, what, 10 Wall Street banks too big to fail have become 5 even bigger, more powerful Wall Street banks, and thousands of community banks have gone out of business. This is an example of crony capitalism. So we need to repeal Dodd-Frank just like we need to repeal Obamacare.
Right, right. What she described did not happen because of Dodd-Frank. It happened in spite of Dodd-Frank because of Republican opposition to efforts to actually implement Dodd-Frank. And it also demonstrates that Dodd-Frank doesn't go far enough. Not that we should repeal it, but that we should add to it and strengthen it. But anyhow, back to Bernie. Let's go to clip number three. Well, actually, clip number two here, Jim. He talks about how super PACs have more say over the campaigns than the candidates do. And I think we just demonstrated that with Carly Fiorina sucking up to banksters, Scott Walker sucking up to the oil barons. Here's what Bernie had to say about that.
According to the Sunlight Foundation, more than $2 out of every $3 raised for presidential candidates so far are going to super PACs, not to the candidates' own campaigns. This is really quite extraordinary. What this means is that super PACs, which theoretically operate independently of the actual candidate, have more influence and more money over the candidate's campaign than the candidate himself or herself.
And as we just demonstrated, and by the way, we would play Hillary Clinton clips about this issue, except to the best of my knowledge, she has not spoken of it. Shane and I looked around this morning. We couldn't find any. And here's, you know, Bernie one more time talking about super PACs and their influence over American politics. Clip number three, Jim.
Mr. President, 35 individuals or companies have already donated more than $1 million to super PACs so far. According to the Associated Press, almost 60 donors have accounted for nearly one-third of all of the money donated so far in the presidential race, including donations to the campaigns themselves. Donors giving at least $100,000 account for close to half of all funds raised.
Now, you'll recall Jimmy Carter last Tuesday, a week ago, yesterday, talking about that on this program, and we'll get to where Bernie is quoting him in just a second. But basically, this is a serious problem. We have candidates who are wholly owned representatives of industries. I mean, shouldn't Scott Walker have to wear a Koch Industries logo on his jacket? Shouldn't Carly Fiorina wear a Goldman Sachs logo on her jacket? I'm almost speechless. When are we going to wake up?
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Or have Americans woke up? And is that why both the Donald Trump on the Republican side and the Bernie Sanders on the Democratic side, the outsider campaigns, are winning? And welcome back. Philip in Bristol, Vermont. Hey, Philip, thanks for watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. What's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, I'm calling about the what you call it there on MSNBC,
Mr. Chris Matthews,
the other night,
yeah,
talking down Bernie, calling him a socialist from Vermont and Russia and all this crap, you know. He's an airhead. He's a bag of wind. And you know what I'm getting scared about?
He's actually, Philip, respectfully, Chris Matthews is one of the smartest guys in the media. And that's why you have to take that kind of an attack very seriously, because he didn't just, you know, pull that out of his backside one day. That's strategic. Now, whether it's strategic because he's affiliated with the Clinton campaign, or whether it's strategic because he's just, you know, doesn't like seeing an outsider, you know, win in the insider's game, I don't know. But back to you, Philip.
Okay, that's what I'm saying, Tom, about Mr. Matthews. I agree, he's a very smart man. I've been watching him for a number of years, but he's just irking me a little bit. But on the other side of this, Tom, I'm seeing that what they're trying to do, I think they're really scared now that Hillary's going to – that's why we're getting the Biden influence. And
right.
I don't think – I think we're seeing the Joe McCarthy, what happened – or not Joe McCarthy, but McCarthy in the 70s when Kennedy saw that Lyndon Johnson had that chance, you know, of losing, he butted right in there. And I'm a Kennedy fan, but, you know, I thought that was a bad thing on Bobby's part because he waited till he saw.
Bobby would have won it, though, if he hadn't been assassinated.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. I agree.
And he would have won the White House.
Oh, definitely agree. Again, I agree with you, Tom. But what I'm trying to say, I just really believe that they're trying to set a Biden to beat Bernie, so that they can have their candidate.
I agree.
The Democratic Party.
I agree. They want to make sure it's an insider who wins, and if the insider isn't going to be Hillary, it'll be Joe Biden. I agree.
That's right.
And if not, and if Joe Biden doesn't jump in, if they can stoke a fire under Martin O'Malley, it'll be him. Although I think he's a very, very weak candidate. The thing I think that the Democratic Party is struggling with is they've got a bunch of good outsider candidates, you know, who could run a serious campaign and really catch fire in America. Sherrod Brown, for example. I mean, you know, there's some good folks there, in addition to Bernie Sanders. But they don't have a lot of good insider candidates, you know, good loyal corporate conservatives. The American people don't want them anymore.
And I hope America sees through what's going on down there in Washington. Again, Tom, I thank you for your time and everything you do for us.
Yeah, okay. Thank you, Philip. Thanks for the call. This is the really important distinction. I keep saying it on this program, and I think probably it's starting to sink in. The more often I say it, the better I understand it, actually, is that it's not about, you know, progressives versus conservatives. It's not about blue dogs and yellow dogs versus old-fashioned Democrats. It's about insiders versus outsiders. And the insiders run the game. It's like the mafia. If you're an insider, you're a made man. You will always have a place on MSNBC to go if you want to say something. Or you will always have a place on Fox News. I mean, there's insiders on both sides. Although Fox News has positioned itself as outsider media. And there's no equivalent to that in the corporate media on the left, only on the right, which I think was the huge mistake that MSNBC made when they reinvented their programming and decided to go even more insider, more corporate, rather than more outsider the way that Fox has. But that, you know, that aside, this, you know, this attack by Chris Matthews on Bernie Sanders is all about that we don't want an outsider seriously running for president. And, you know, of course, the rationale that they use is the last time that happened, it was George McGovern and he lost everything. Well, no, it's a terrible analogy. It doesn't work. We'll be back. It's 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Actually, we do have a Hillary Clinton clip on these topics, and bless her for it. Here is Hillary Clinton speaking to the issue of money and the corrosive influence of money in politics.
We need to fix our dysfunctional political system and get unaccountable money out of it once and for all, even if that takes a constitutional amendment.
Wow. So good on you, Hillary. And this is why I say, you know, even if Bernie is not the nominee, I will support Hillary Clinton. I don't think she's a terrible candidate. I think, you know, I think she'd make a great president. A wonderful thing to have a woman as a president. That said, I think Bernie can easily beat any Republican and would make a fabulous president. So, but anyhow, back to Bernie. Here is where Bernie yesterday on the floor of the Senate. Keep in mind, this was not a campaign speech. You know, although he's coming to Portland. In fact, this is Sean Sean Taylor, our executive producer, who lives in Portland, made this interesting comment. Oh, this is yesterday's. This is yesterday's one sheet. Anyhow, that both Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders are coming to Portland for the weekend, and Hillary Clinton is doing a fundraiser, a private fundraiser, $2,700 a plate, and Bernie has rented a facility, which Memorial Coliseum. Oh, there's my one sheet. Memorial Coliseum. No, that's for our New Mexico. That'll hold 12,000 people. But back to the clips. Here's Bernie calling out the Koch brothers, number four, Jim.
We know, for example, that the Koch brothers, worth some $85 billion, the second wealthiest family in America, have made public that they intend to spend some $900 million on this election. This is more money than either the Democratic Party or the Republican Party will spend. One family spending more money than either the Democratic Party or the Republican Party.
So, and then Bernie says, you know, it's time to just call it what it is, right? Here's clip number five. This is Bernie yesterday on the floor of the Senate.
How do we describe a process in which one multi-billion dollar family spends more money on a campaign than either of the two major political parties? Well, I define that process not as democracy, but as oligarchy. Let's be honest and acknowledge what we are talking about. We are talking about a rapid movement in this country toward a political system in which a handful of very, very wealthy people and special interests will determine who gets elected or who does not get elected.
The U.S. has become an oligarchy. And finally, here's Senator Sanders quoting President Carter, quote, on this program, which this was really cool because I don't know if you extended this, Jim, to where he says, would you please read this into the record? Oh, you did? Cool. Play it.
Last week, this is what former President Jimmy Carter had to say about the current campaign finance system on the Tom Hartman radio show. President Carter stated that unlimited money in politics, and I quote, violates the essence of what made America a great country in its political system. Now it's just an oligarchy, with unlimited political bribery being the essence of getting the nominations for president or to elect the president. And the same thing applies to governors and U.S. senators and Congress members. So now we have just seen a complete subversion of our political system as a payoff to major contributors who want and expect and sometimes get favors for themselves after the election's over. End of quote. Mr. President, I would ask unanimous consent to put into the record President Carter's full statement.
There you go. And Mr. President says, okay, cool. So, we're for the record, in the congressional record. So, here's the details. Bernie and Hillary are both going to be in Portland, Oregon. Hillary is in town tonight, and this is the $2,700 plate dinner to private residents. I don't know if there's any plates open for that. I'm guessing you could find out at hillaryclinton.com. Bernie is in town on Sunday, and it will be a free open public event at the Memorial Coliseum, which seats 12,800 people. And it's going to be really interesting. I mean, Portland's a very progressive town, and people in Portland have been listening to Bernie for a long, long time on this program. It'll be really interesting to see how many people show up. I was talking to one of my kids yesterday, who all three of our kids live in Portland, too. And who was telling me that she was really excited Bernie was coming to town and everybody's getting all, you know, pumped up about it. And it's like, you know, Bernie shows up at these events. I don't even, you know, it's like his campaign doesn't, maybe they must just email out to people in the neighborhood because, you know, I'm on their mailing list and I don't get an announcement of these things. So Anyhow, we'll pick up your phone calls. It's Anything Goes Summer here on the Tom Hartman program. And your thoughts on this and others and what's going to go on with the Republicans. And, oh, I got to tell you what's the matter with Kansas, too.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman program. Call 202-536-2370.
I mean, it's absolutely mind-boggling what's going on in Kansas with their schools right now because of Sam Brownback's Reagan-esque stupidity. Welcome back. It's 28 minutes before the hour. I'm Tom Hartman. This is your media support group for We the People of the United States of America and really all over the world, and not just We the People. I mean, all life forms, right? I mean, we're all we don't exist in a vacuum. We don't exist all by ourselves, and it doesn't work that way. I mean, which is why this whole, fact that we're entering the sixth extinction right now, that we are in the midst of a sixth extinction, is so damn troubling. Rob in Greenwood, California. Hey, Rob, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Thanks so much for taking my call. Boy, that's an interesting topic you bring up right there, too, but I guess I'll try and stick to the subject that I called originally for. Big fan of yours. I listen to you almost every day. I guess the central point I want to make is that Bernie Sanders, Senator Bernie Sanders, is the only candidate out there that's really discussing socioeconomics in any realistic fashion. You know this just as well as anyone. Yeah. I thank you so much for your support of him. One of the questions I had for you, as a historian, I read your book 2016. I love it. Looking forward to getting the book between the correspondence between Abigail and John. The idea of a large middle class in this country, I contend that it largely was a result. We've never really historically have large middle classes in society. They make a small population. But post-World War II, with FDR's very socially progressive platform and his programs, the working people of America, for the first time really in history, had extra money and security for their lives and were able to gain some semblance of comfort.
Yeah, America was a democratic socialist nation from 1933 until 1981.
Yes, and most people simply recognize themselves as working people. I don't think the idea of, hey, I'm a middle-class person, really emerged until post-World War II when regular Joes finally could buy a home and have a car and have a family.
Right.
But as you have mentioned many times, since Reagan was elected, those programs have been just sliced and diced, and working people are finding out that, hey, maybe the idea of middle class isn't what we were living, because we're all really now one or two paychecks away from poverty. But again, the aristocracy that was in Europe, that was brought over here, you mentioned it in your book, Crash of 2016, the aristocracy of wealth in this country has forever controlled the economics, but they are now, for the first time, gaining complete and total control of the politics as well.
Right. And it's not really the first time. I would say that it also happened in the 1880s and 90s.
Well, and also you can also, I guess, argue that, you know, the Civil War was a war fought against a slave-owning aristocracy in the South. But really, Bernie is the only one bringing this point to the attention of the American people that, look, this wealthy aristocracy is trying to take over completely. And it's so sad to see the complete, almost total media blackout and minimalization of him.
Yeah.
It seems like you know, most of the centralized media, they simply trivialize him, they minimalize him, they try and make him out to, like you say, an outsider.
Yeah, well, he is an outsider, and that's why. I mean, Bernie has he's an independent. He didn't even join the Democratic Party. He ran in the Democratic primaries in Vermont several times and always won. And then said, okay, now that, you know, we've got the Democratic candidate, me, I'm going to run as an independent.
I think he's been an independent most of his political career, but obviously he has to run on the Democratic ticket to not split it.
Yes, and that's very wise. He doesn't want to be responsible for a Republican being elected.
I agree. But I wanted to get your thought on that, on the idea of, you know, did we have this large middle class because of our educational system, or was it the idea of now working people actually had some security and they could emerge into what might be even lower middle class.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I think we have to consider that there were two stages of New Deal middle class generation, as it were, middle class creation. And the first was just for white people. And that was from 1932 until the 1960s. And black GIs coming back from World War II were not eligible, as my father was, to buy a home with a VA loan. Most cases, they couldn't go to college with the GI Bill. And when they could, it was very, very difficult. I mean, basically, what happened was FDR built the white middle class for the first time in the history of the United States, a really solid white middle class. And then Lyndon Johnson came along and said, you know, it's time to bring African-Americans into this as well, signed the Civil Rights Act, signed the Voting Rights Act, and started the Great Society, which was a program designed to provide bootstraps to people who didn't have them so they could start pulling themselves up. And the consequence of the Great Society in the 1960s was that in the 1970s and 80s, we saw the emergence of a black middle class in a really substantial way in the United States as well. And now, of course, as, you know, 34 years of Reaganism designed to dismantle a middle class of any kind.
Yeah.
The black middle class was the first to go because it was the most fragile. They had the least, you know, resources and wealth. And then the white middle class started going. And when the white middle class started going, that's when, you know, white people started going, hey, wait a minute. And since white people are the majority in this country and control most of the power structures and all of the media, or at least all of the main media, you know, suddenly it's something that we're talking about. Whereas, you know, black people could have told you about this all along. So I think that we need to keep that in mind. But I agree with you, Rob, that Bernie is the only guy who is seriously talking about this. Hillary talks about it in broad strokes, but not so far. I mean, there's still a lot of time in the campaign, but not so far I haven't heard specific policy prescriptions coming out of her campaign. Although
the only one really with a platform.
Well, yeah, really, so far. I mean, you know, yes. And to a certain extent, the nominee and the party have to do that dance to come up with the platform, because arguably it's the party that comes up with the platform. But, you know, I expect that we'll hear a lot more specifics coming out of Hillary Clinton as time goes on. But on the Republican side, the number of Republicans who are talking about a middle class or working class, you know, elevating the working class is zero. I mean, they're all competing with each other about how they can trash the middle class, how they can cut Social Security, which allows fully a third of seniors right now would be living in poverty if it weren't for Social Security, and you know, not being in poverty.
My mom is actually a senior on Social Security disability, and I moved up to her home almost 3 years ago to be her care provider.
Yeah.
And so
you know what I'm talking about.
She's living right on the edge.
Yeah.
You know, we're
The Republicans are fighting over who can cut Social Security fastest. They put into the House rules on the first day in January of this new Congress of this year, a small bomb, you know, they lit the fuse, and the bomb is going to go off in October of next year, just in time for the election, where Social Security disability is going to run out of money, and they're refusing to do the routine transfer of money from the various programs. Right.
Yeah.
They're inventing a crisis. I mean, this is Naomi Klein's disaster capitalism on steroids.
Yeah,
and,
wonderful lady.
And then the Republicans are fighting over who's going to be the fastest to deregulate the banks, who's going to be the fastest to deregulate the billionaires, who wants to do away with the estate tax. Rand Paul's out there talking about a flat tax. I had an Uber driver the night before or last night, but it was Monday night, was the Republican panel, right? So it was Monday night. I was driving home from the TV studio in an Uber car, and he was listening on C-SPAN radio to Rand Paul. And Rand Paul started talking about his flat tax, and I made a smart-ass remark sitting in the back seat, and the guy was like, hey, you know, I'm a Rand Paul supporter. And I said, don't you get it that the flat tax is going to raise your taxes and lower the taxes on millionaires? And he's like, no, it's supposed to help every, you know, it's like, how do you even reason with these people? But anyway, you know, this young guy thought he was a libertarian, right? And doesn't understand econ. But you're right, Rob. Rob, I got to move along, but thank you for the call. Great to hear from you. Michael in Cordova, Tennessee. Hey, Michael, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Good. What's on your mind?
I listen to your show every day, you know, I agree with Bernie's and Hillary. You know, I'm a loyal Democrat, but Well, what I'm hearing lately is kind of concerning to me, you know, with Bernie, some of Bernie's supporters. You know, it seems to me like, I wonder, are they lower Democrats? Or are they Reagan Democrats?
I don't know what you're talking about, Michael.
The reason I say that because you had some people call in your show last week that was that, you know, like Bernie Sanders, you know, block parties and stuff like that. And the first thing that came out of their mouth was that they were angry at Obama because he didn't arrest any of the bankers, or they're, you know, say something really bad about Hillary Clinton. And several of them said if Bernie didn't win, they'll vote for the Green Party. So I'm trying to figure out, are they loyal Democrats, or are these the
I think the number of Bernie supporters who will vote for the Green Party is probably very, very small, Michael. And to the best of my knowledge, only one person has ever called this show and said that. The vast majority of people last Wednesday when the Bernie house parties were going on, I didn't hear anybody criticize President Obama. Maybe somebody did. And I didn't hear anybody criticizing Hillary Clinton. I know that the Hillary campaign is putting out all this stuff about how, you know, Bernie Sanders is quote, not good on civil rights. Bernie Sanders started his political career in 1962 leading a sit-in at the University of Chicago to protest segregated housing. He was an officer in the Congress on Racial Equality, CORE. Bernie Sanders, the reason he hasn't been addressing race issues up until the last couple of weeks is because he felt he didn't have to, because he's been working in those areas for his whole entire life. Michael, thank you for the call. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And in fact, actually, he has been directly responding to race issues throughout his campaign. I shouldn't say that he just started to. Welcome back. Let's see here. Oneida in Maine, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. Hey, Oneida, what's up?
Hi. I just wondered, I tried to get you for the last week and to tell you about MSNBC. In case you didn't know it, I had written a letter to MSNBC with a copy to Free Speech. What, could I read two paragraphs to you?
I'd rather you didn't. Can you just tell me what it says, Oneida?
It says that they announced on when Comcast purchased GE, a stock from MSNBC, became the owner, MSNBC announced a format change in the future.
Right.
And it started when they dumped Joy Reid. I gave her another job, but they took her off at 2 o'clock. And then the hammer came down Friday when...
On Ed Schultz. On Ed Schultz, yeah.
But they started with Alex Wagner, and then a cycle, and then they hit Ed Schultz, and it just angered me to the point where I couldn't see straight. And I listed in this letter for his Truth of Power on Keystone and TPP, annoying the president, angering the fossil fuel corporation advertisers, his stand with labor and the people of Wisconsin against the Koch money with Governor Walker. That no doubt angered the Kansas billionaire and the Wisconsin money investors supporting Walker for his presidential run. And then he did a whole week on BP, damage to the U.S. Gulf, and the failure to make things good, and the government's failure to bring accountability. He's done so much that it just, that was our Truth to Power, the people that listen to the lineup in the evening for MSNBC. And it got replaced with just plain news. And a bunch of pundits coming on to give you their opinion instead of somebody that's actually doing something and speaking for something or against something. And I know that that's his punishment for annoying so many people that put money into the pocket of Comcast. It just really peeled me off.
Yeah. Oneida, I understand and I agree with you. Ed Schultz is a colleague and a friend, and he has been speaking truth to power for a long time. and good on him for it. And he did a great job at MSNBC, and he left gracefully, which I, you know, impressed me. And now he's doing, I think, podcasts over at WeGotEd.com. And I don't disagree with your analysis. I think that MSNBC, now that Comcast owns it, has decided that they're and it's owned by NBC, which is owned by Comcast, has decided that they're just going to go full insider. They're going to go full corporate Dem. And frankly, in the morning, it's full Republican. I mean, you had Joe Scarborough this morning misrepresenting Elizabeth Warren's comments and misrepresenting Planned Parenthood. It's just astonishing. So MSNBC is no longer a liberal network, you know, with the exception, I'd say, of the Rachel Maddow Show and Melissa Harris Perry on the weekends, who does just a spectacular job. Oneida, thank you for the call. You want a progressive network? It's right here. It's called Free Speech TV, and that's why we need to be supporting. We'll be back. Ten minutes before the hour, occupied the media, 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Harbin here with you, and Charlie in Windsor, Ohio. Hey, Charlie, what's on your mind?
Good morning. The other day I was trying to finish up a project around here, and my wife was watching TV. I was in a different room. All of a sudden, in her loudest outside voice, she screams, "Bull!" And you know the other part of it.
Yeah. Thank you for not saying it on the air.
Yes. I come in and say, "What's the matter, babe?" And she had stumbled across this channel with Dick Morris on there.
On the radio?
On the TV. I don't know what channel it was. But.
Well, if it was Dick Morris, it was probably Fox News. But it might have been Newsmax. Who knows?
Well, that's what it was. It wasn't Fox News. I'm prohibited from watching that. So anyway, he made this astronomical quote, a six-figure number of cases of voter fraud. And that was a bull part for her.
Yeah.
So then I started watching it, and I was flabbergasted by the outright lies. I wonder how can they get away with that?
It's called the First Amendment. You may lie. It's that's why you find venues like Newsmax TV and whatnot. I don't want to say that they're there to lie, but typically they don't, for example, take phone calls from listeners who might challenge them. And Dick Morris will not tolerate being challenged. I challenged him once on this program, and he hung up on me. And literally, and has refused to come back on the program since then. That was 6 or 7 years ago. So, but that's how they get away with it. I mean, and many of them are. Look at this Iran deal thing. You know, I had two conservative consultants on my TV show last night. And they literally did not know that the nuclear facilities in Iran are going to be subject to 24/7 continuous inspection. And, you know, they thought that you had to ask permission 24 days in advance. That's for the non-nuclear facilities. That's if you want to go into the Ayatollah's bathroom. That's if you want to go into the office of the president and go and rifle through his desk. That's if you want to go to some, you know, military facility where the army is, but there aren't any, you know, there's no evidence of any nuclear weapons. You want to do that, you got to ask permission. And that's not an unreasonable thing. We've got, you know, nuclear inspectors here in the United States, and they're not allowed to inspect Dick Cheney's office or now it's Joe Biden's office. You know, it's like, and these guys literally did not know this. Same thing with the Planned Parenthood stuff. They thought that Planned Parenthood is selling, you know, aborted baby parts. Well, you know, A, they're not babies, fetus parts. B, they're not selling them. And C, it was Mitch McConnell who pushed this legislation through and voted for it to allow women who are having abortions to donate the tissue from those abortions to medical research, which, by the way, looks like it's going to help solve the problem of Parkinson's and has already been used to develop, you know, some very, very potent vaccines. These are stem cells and things. And suddenly the Republicans want to come in and say, no, women cannot donate their fetal tissue for medical research. They can't do it because it's gross, right? I mean, this makes no sense. So literally, these people, they live in this Fox-verse, and the Newsmax-verse is even wackier. They live in these alternate realities. I just saw a story this morning about how in one of the areas out west where the Jade Helm exercises are going on right now, second day in a row, the soldiers are hearing people shooting in the air. Some guy in a red pickup truck is running around shooting at the army. It's like, because he's watching, you know, one of these right wing channels or one of these right wing shows, and he's all hysterical and worried about it. But the answer to your question, Charlie, is the First Amendment does not require truth. It opens the airwaves, it opens discourse, it opens whatever to anybody. You know, unfortunately now anybody who has enough money. But that's pretty much it. Charlie, thank you for the call. Ralph in Knoxville, Tennessee. Hey, Ralph, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I think Bernie's candidacy has already been a good thing because it's held Hillary's feet to the fire. You know, she's off the fence on a lot of things she probably would be on the fence with. But no, what I called about, I'm a school crossing guard here in Knoxville, and we had our annual meeting yesterday, and I was surrounded by Republicans. You know, and I was trying to push Bernie, you know, and they bring up a good point. I know you've lived in Scandinavia, you know, for a while.
I lived in Germany, I've been to Scandinavia.
Okay. I was wondering, their system, you know, a democratic socialistic system.
Right.
They have
Germany also.
Health care.
Yeah.
Oh, did it?
Yeah.
Well, guaranteed health care, guaranteed retirement. But no matter where you go, and we got to say in here in Tennessee, you know, there's some people who wants to track a lick at a snake. What do you do with people if we were to get lucky enough to get a system like that, which I don't ever see it happen in my lifetime because I'm 70, but I hope so. But what do you do with people? What do they do with people that just will not work, refuse to work?
Well,
I'll take you.
First of all, Ralph, what you find is that there is, in every society, there is a very, very small subset of people who just refuse to work, who you know, are, if there's any way to exploit the system, they're going to do it. And it typically is between 1% and 3%. And so the question is, are we willing to protect everybody in the country? And by the way, we do have democratic socialism here in the United States. Social Security is a democratic socialist program. Medicare is a democratic socialist program. I'm guessing if you're 70, you're benefiting from both of those. These are things that we borrowed from Northern Europe and Scandinavia. We have a lot of democratic Medicaid, Medicare and Medicaid are both democratic socialist programs. And, you know, there's no shortage of other ones. Public schools, for example, free public schooling is a democratic socialist idea. But the question we have to ask is, are we willing to put up with 1%, 2%, or 3% of the people abusing the system in order to have a system that works for the other 98%, 99%, 97% of us? And I say yes. In corporate America, you've got waste and fraud, you know, and skimming off the top from the CEOs that probably runs 15%, 20% in most corporations. And they're willing to tolerate that. I think for the benefit of saying, yes, we'd like to have these programs. So if I was surrounded by Republicans and they were saying, oh, Bernie's a socialist, I'd say, yeah, he supports those democratic socialist programs like Social Security and Medicare. And I understand that the Republicans hate that, and they have always fought against those things, and they want to turn them over to the banksters. And if you think that the banksters on Wall Street should be running your Social Security and your Medicare, by all means, vote for a Republican. But I think it's a crazy idea. Ralph, thank you for the call.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And Neil McCabe on the line with us, political director of Gravis Insights, Florida-based pollster, columnist with townhall.com. Gravisinsights.com is the website. Neil, welcome back.
Glad to be with you, Tom.
Hey, a mutual friend, Little Bird, last night told me that you might be moving back to Washington, D.C.
Absolutely. I will be joining One America News Network starting August 17th.
How cool is that? Well, I look forward to having you in person in the future, assuming that your new job will let you do that.
That was a condition of my employment that I continue my relationship.
Okay,
with Tom
great.
Hartman's media empire.
Okay, thank you, Neil. I've got this bizarre story here. This is from Computer World. And the FCC is being sued by no fewer than 10 different lawsuits right now against the Obama administration and the FCC, one of them by Comcast, against net neutrality. They all want to end net neutrality. And one of the more interesting ones is the argument that AT&T and Verizon and Alamo have made, Alamo Broadband, which is, I'm assuming, probably a Texas company. I'm not familiar with it. But they actually, in their lawsuit, they say that the essentially net neutrality prohibits broadband providers from elevating their speech over others and selling the ability to prioritize some speech over other speech. In other words, here is the internet service provider, the company that is going to sell you your internet access, saying, we believe that our corporate First Amendment free speech right means that we should be able to force our content, or content that people have paid us to promote, that we should be able to shove that down the tube, so that when people log on to the internet, they automatically see our ads, they automatically see our websites, and we should be able to say, you know, there are websites that we just don't like, and we want to diminish the ability to get to them. Like, you know, Comcast, very conservative family owns Comcast, very conservative corporation. You know, they would just really rather not let, I don't know that they would, but let's say that they wanted to say, you know, any of the liberal sites, you're going to have to pay extra, or they're going to come to you slowly.
Let's think about this, Tom. I mean, just to hear it, maybe put it in another context, the South Boston St. Patrick's Day Parade was organized and put on by the Catholic war veterans, and then there were groups who were supporting behaviors and practices that were considered sinful by the Catholic Church, and they went to court basically saying, you're having a parade on public streets. We should be able to have a float in our parade, even though it's something that's completely against what you stand for. And so the question is, does the parade belong to the people, or does the parade belong to the people who run the parade?
Just no, like it's the wrong metaphor,
Neil. Do the pipes belong to the people?
That's the wrong.
To the people who own them.
It's the wrong metaphor. Well, first of all, the pipes pass through publicly owned property. So really the argument should, you know, if you want to make an argument or a metaphor, you need to use common carriers. But what these internet service providers are saying is that, let's say that, FedEx decided that they were going to make the exact same argument. Their argument would be, we should have the right to say, if something's coming from Neil McCabe's house and we don't like his politics, we're going to charge him extra. If anything comes out of Neil McCabe's house and we don't like his politics, we should be able to open it, inspect it, and if we really don't like it, slow down its delivery. They can't do that because of common carrier laws. Phone companies, if they wanted to make the same argument that these internet service providers are making, because they're regulated under the same Title II of the Communications Act now, are common carriers.
Right.
Phone companies would be coming out saying, you know, we don't like, or we do like, Neil McCabe or Tom Hartman's political speech. And so we're going to listen to their phone conversations. And whenever they're talking about things that we don't like, we're going to disconnect them from time to time. Or we're going to charge them $2 a minute to talk to their political buddies and only $1 a minute to talk to grandma. And that's wrong. It's illegal.
One of the problems is, I read that article and I got kind of confused. And I think maybe I talked about it with the same bird you know. And I think that bird was confused, is that, you know, is there a legal vulnerability? For instance, is Alamo legally vulnerable if they carry something that's offensive or pornographic or racist? And if they're vulnerable to the content that flows over their pipes, they have a responsibility to administer and edit and monitor. And so I think ISPs are trying to determine what their legal vulnerability is, because
good point. There's two sides to that. The standard for carriage for other common carriers, trucking companies, airlines, telephone companies, is reasonableness, right? If UPS starts noticing that a lot of packages are coming out of your house and they smell like pot and they're going to people all over the country, or right. that one of them's leaking heroin, they have a legal obligation to report that. But that doesn't mean that they have a legal obligation or even the ability to inspect every package coming out of your house. It's just if there's something suspicious. And in fact, the extent to which that they would assert the right to inspect every package coming out of your house increases their liability. It doesn't decrease it. So an internet service provider right now operating under common carrier rules, just like a phone company. If it's suspected that a phone company's user is signing people up for jihad or for child porn or something like that, if there's any evidence that becomes obvious to the phone company, then they have an obligation to report it and to do something about it. But they don't have the obligation to go looking for it, because that would be invasive. That would be a violation of common carrier rules and arguably of the Fourth Amendment.
But there's certainly an opportunistic, litigious community of lawyers who you know, we can say, well, it's reasonable and unreasonable.
Then the best defense is to say net neutrality. You know, because of net neutrality, we don't have any say. We don't have the ability to control the content.
I think it's a lot easier if we move away from sort of a government Soviet-type monitoring or whatever, net neutrality. Just sort of, let's just go back.
Excuse me, net neutrality is not monitored by the government, and it has nothing to do with the Soviet Union, Neil. Come on.
Well, not yet.
Net neutrality, you're conflating the NSA spying on us with Comcast spying on us, and Comcast spies on us because they want to make a buck.
Listen, if I own a railroad, I have control of the railroad cars, and I charge you depending on how many cars you fill. And I think so that's common carrier, right?
That is correct, but you cannot charge me. And in fact, this goes back. This was what provoked the Sherman Antitrust Act. This is why the state of Ohio tried to prosecute John Rockefeller, and why he left Ohio and moved Standard Oil to New Jersey back in the 1890s, was because he cut a deal with Jay Gould, with the railroad baron, where they would transport oil from the Standard Oil monopolies at 3 cents a train car or a barrel or whatever, but if it came from one of the small independents, it was 5 cents. In other words, they had different prices depending on who you were. And so we have common carrier rules. If you own a railroad, yeah, you can say you want to ship 1,000 pounds of stuff, here's the price. But you can't say, do you want to ship 1,000 pounds of stuff to Neil? Oh, well, if it goes to Neil, we charge extra. Or if it comes from Neil, we charge extra. Or if we don't like what's in those boxes, that 1,000 pounds of stuff, if we discover that it's, Chinese-made goods instead of made-in-America goods, we're going to charge it. They can't do that.
But I think if things are better, go back to the old days, sir.
You'd rather have the robber barons running the show.
Listen, Rockefeller saved the whale, by the way, and you never mention it.
Okay, you're right on that. Neil McCabe, political director with GravisInsights.com. Thank you, Neil.
All right, be good.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Amazing. Amazing. How can anybody not support net neutrality? I mean, it's just, I'm down. Welcome back. 15 minutes past the hour. And amazing stuff out there. Morris in Long Beach, California, listening on KPFK. Hey, Morris, what's up?
All right, Professor. We're all political scientists. Now, here we go. I'm in charge of the Martin O'Malley campaign. He said something that got my attention.
Okay.
He addressed voting rights. And as you know, the Supreme Court has gutted voting privileges in this country. And as you know, since that time, 468 restrictive laws have been passed in this country. Now, what we're going to do here, what appears Martin O'Malley is doing, is he's attacking the Southern Manifesto here. Now, this is going to be our strategy. We're going to have him appear with people like William Barber, Ralph Nader, the LGBT, Black Lives Matter, and have him refer, instead of speaking on what he is going to do, just say, my campaign is found on the People's Ten Commandments, www.thepeople. That's our platform in Florida and California, all over. And let the spirit of the movement speak instead of him speaking. So what do you think?
Yeah, I'm all for it. And, amending the Constitution to introduce an affirmative right to vote for all U.S. citizens is something that I would be surprised if Hillary Clinton didn't support it. And I know over the years, Bernie Sanders on this program has talked favorably about such a thing. And I'm really glad that Martin O'Malley is, you know, making that one to hit the flags in the sand that he's gonna, or the hill that he's gonna, you know, fight on. And good for him, you know, good on him for that. I think that it's a great thing.
Professor, would you say that the party is moving to the left?
No, I think that the party is moving back to the back to what used to be considered the center in America prior to Reagan, which is, you know, keep in mind, you know, Dwight Eisenhower in 1956 running for re-election bragged about the fact that he had expanded Social Security. He had increased the number of people who had union, you know, access to union jobs, who were members of unions. He had taken some serious steps. They weren't as consequential as what Lyndon Johnson did, but some serious steps to reduce racial discrimination in this country. And you know, step by step, I mean, I think that I don't think we're going to the left. You can call it the left because we've swung so far to the right, Morris, but I think we're going back to the center, back to the fundamental American values that, you know, anybody in this country who works a 40-hour week and keeps their nose clean should be able to live a decent job, should have a decent job, should be able to live a decent life.
Would you think Mr. O'Malley would be able to compete if he followed my strategy?
I think so, yeah. My concern about Martin O'Malley so far is, you know, we've reached out to his campaign a couple of times and said, you know, you want to come on the program, here's an opportunity for you. No. It just, you know, and it's not like I'm insulted or something. It concerns me that they don't have, as far as I can tell, a strong media strategy. You know, they're really not trying to do outreach to the base. You want to reach the base, it's not just my show, obviously, but hey, here's an entry point. And you know, we've reached out to the Clinton campaign. We've reached out to Jim Webb's campaign. To Lincoln Chafee's campaign, none of them want to come on. And you know, I don't get it. I don't get, you know, I don't see the excitement and enthusiasm. And I think if we're going to beat a Republican in the fall, we've got to have a candidate who really fires people up. And I think Hillary Clinton can do that. And I know that Bernie Sanders can do that.
Bernie Sanders is the only one that you talk about firing up people. Right now, that's Mr. Sanders. No slight on Ms. Clinton, but that's Bernie Sanders right now. She's got too much association with Wall Street, so.
I think you're probably right, Morris. I hope that doesn't bite her in the general if she's the nominee. We'll see, though. Morris, thanks for the call, and thank you for calling. I just said that, didn't I? We'll be right back. In the last hour, I mentioned, welcome back to the Tom Hartman program, I mentioned that I was going to tell you what's going on with Kansas. Kansas has, ever since Sam Brownback, actually according to a statistician at the Kansas or the Wichita or whatever it is, I'd have to go track the story down. But according to a statistician, ever since Sam Brownback stole the election by manipulating voting machines, in 2010, he has tried Reaganomics. He radically slashed taxes on billionaires and corporations in Kansas, especially one of the Koch brothers who lives in Kansas, saw his state taxes presumably plummet. And the result is that there's this giant hole in the Kansas budget. So what's Sam Brownback doing? Well, he's cutting money to the schools in Kansas. Well, Kansas now has, in this last year, 4,512 teachers have left Kansas. And, it's been averaging around 4,000 a year for the last 3 years, ever since Sam Brownback did this, that teachers are fleeing the state because now the state is, they're making it, well, here's the list. Kansas, this is from the Center for American Progress's blog, Andrew Briner writing over at Think Progress. Several districts, while the tax cut experiment didn't create jobs, it did destroy the Kansas budget, and one major consequence has been massive funding cuts for Kansas schools. Several school districts ended the school year early for lack of funds. Education funding levels are so low in Kansas and unequal across school districts that judges have ruled them unconstitutional, and the case is currently pending at the state Supreme Court. Kansas teacher pay is among the lowest in the nation. The Kansas legislature has removed teachers' tenure protections, tried to make it possible to criminally prosecute them for teaching what the Republicans consider to be offensive material. What is that? Didn't we already have that? It's a Scopes Monkey trial? Oh, that's right. Scopes lost, right? Or won, or whatever. You know, the creationists won the Scopes monkey trial. And that was in Kansas, too, wasn't it? I think it was. It was either there. No, it was in Tennessee, as I recall. And they've attempted to weaken collective bargaining. Teachers are retiring in fear that the state will soon target their retirement benefits, one superintendent from a nearby Missouri school district said. There are double the normal openings for school staff in Kansas. Teachers are quitting and retiring at high rates, and new teachers aren't looking to start careers in Kansas. So what does the Brownback administration, what do the Republicans in Kansas, what are they going to do about this fact that, you know, they have a teacher shortage right now because qualified teachers are saying, screw this, I'm out of here. They're lowering the standards for teachers. They're saying you don't actually have to go to teacher's college to be a teacher. You don't have to have a teaching certificate to have a teacher. Well, you know, we'll just, you know, bring in people off the street. You know, we'll have sort of standards, right? This is actually being promoted by ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, legislation in every state legislature across the country that would lower the standards for teachers. Why? Why would they do this? Why would Republicans do this? This is the oldest trick in the book. This David Stockman laid this out in his tell-all autobiography, apologizing for his time as budget director, the head of OMB in the Reagan administration, when he said that the strategy that was employed by the Republicans during the 1980s, and it's still going on to this day, is called Starve the Beast. And what you do is you take the school systems are working just fine, right? So what do? We cut their funding. Well, suddenly they're not working so fine. And then the teachers, you know, the qualified teachers start leaving, and so we put in unqualified teachers. And then we point at the school systems. We look at these government-funded schools. They got people who aren't even teachers teaching, and the standards are falling, you know, and we need to privatize this. So it is, I mean, Naomi Klein wrote a whole book about this on disaster capitalism. This only, in this case, they're creating the disaster. So this is what Republicans do. They try to break government whenever they're in charge of it so that then, you know, they can sell the public on the idea that, you know, hey, government is broken. I guess we need to turn that over to the billionaires, turn that over to the private sector, turn that over to Goldman Sachs, turn that over to ExxonMobil. Let the Koch brothers regulate themselves. You know, they know how much poison to put in the air. We shouldn't be telling them. We don't need no stinking EPA. That's how it works. That's what's going on. And you see this writ large in Kansas. I mean, they're just running the Reagan playbook. And this is why I keep saying if a Republican is elected president next year and the Republicans continue to hold the House and Senate, you are going to see such a vivid replay of 1928, 1929, it will make your head explode. And it might even be a good thing. As much as it pains me to say it, that America needs to, because, you know, throughout the 20s, the 1920s, the Americans thought that the Republicans were just, you know, the cat's meow. Oh, look at, they had a Republican House, they had a Republican Senate. In 1920, Warren Harding ran for president on the platform of deregulating business and privatizing government. His campaign slogan was less government and business, more business and government. And he did it. Oh, and lower taxes. He dropped the top tax rate from 91% down to 25% in 1921. And what did it do? It kicked off a bubble. And that bubble from 1921 to 1929 happened principally in the housing market, in the commodities market, and in the stock market. And the bubble burst in 1929. And then everybody saw, and the Republicans had done nothing for a social safety net. They had fought the social safety net. You had, you know, a conservative Supreme Court that had said child labor laws are unconstitutional. Protecting the right to unionize, unconstitutional. It's interference in the relationship, the private business relationship between an employer and an employee. That, a corporation should be able to hire a 12-year-old or a 10-year-old. And say, okay, you know, here, you know, run this machine. Yeah, you may lose a finger, no big deal. In fact, workplace safety rules were unconstitutional, according to the Supreme Court, back in the 1920s. So this is, you know, welcome back, right? And what does it do? It leads to, it destroys the middle class. It turns people into the working poor. You know, there's this myth that the roaring 20s were, you know, prosperity for everybody. No, it was prosperity for a very, very few. And working people's wages actually declined. What exploded was the stock market. And then it really exploded in 1929. And that's what Sam Brownback's doing. That's what the Republicans are
doing.
You're
listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
It's what the Republicans have always done since the 1880s when their party was taken over by the robber barons. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And, it's a fascinating day. It's just an absolute fascinating time to hear Republicans refusing to talk, with the exception of Donald Trump, refusing to talk about the fact that the, 30 years of Reaganomics has wiped out the middle class. I just find it fascinating. Steve in Bangor, Maine. Hey, Steve, welcome to the program. Steve, can you hear me? Okay, Steve, if you can hear me, call me right back, and I'll put you on the air. Or if you're listening to your radio instead of your telephone, the secret is to listen to your phone because there's a time delay here for the obscenity delay and then also for the, just technology. Tom in Ottawa, Illinois, listening to WCPT. Can you hear me, Tom?
It's Paul.
Okay. That's interesting. It says Tom here. Okay, Paul, what's up?
Okay. I'm a little concerned. Now, as somebody who's always considered himself a Democratic Socialist and be happy to vote for Bernie Sanders if he should get the nomination, but I'm a little doubtful that he could, I keep reading comments from those who support him and hear him on, like, talk shows like yours sometimes that, if he doesn't win, that's it. They're not going to vote for anybody else. Or that it seems like their only concern actually is to get him the nomination, whether or not he wins.
I sit here every day for 3 hours and take the calls and put them on the air. And I don't think out of the hundreds and hundreds of let's talk about Bernie calls that we've gotten in the last, since Bernie announced his campaign for the White House, I don't think I've heard two or three people say that. Where are you getting this stuff from? Are you reading like talking points from the Republican Party?
No, I read the liberal website. I'm a liberal.
Okay, so on what liberal website did you see somebody say that if Bernie doesn't get the nomination, they're not going to vote Democratic or they're not going to vote?
Talking points memo.
Jeez. We're going to X out Paul so he can never call in again. And my apologies if that obscenity slipped through. Marty in Evergreen Park, and more proof to me that Paul wasn't quite what he said he was. In fact, he had given Danielle a different name. But we have caller ID, so he's locked up. Marty in Evergreen Park, Illinois. Hey, Marty, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Good.
Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to say I think I found a candidate running for president that I like as much, if not more, than Bernie Sanders.
And would that be Jill Stein?
Yeah. And I was listening to her with an interview on Larry King, and just how intelligent and how brilliant she is. And
yeah, she's a physician. She's very good on all the issues. I've had Jill on this program. I've interviewed her a number of times on TV. I moderated a debate in Chicago 4 years ago. Along with Larry King, in which Jill was part of the debate. And she's great. That said, she's never going to be president of the United States.
I know. And what I think is even more disheartening is that a vote, if you wanted to vote for somebody like that, it would in essence be a vote against the Democratic nominee, even if it is Bernie Sanders, even if I want him to be president.
And essentially in favor of the Republican nominee. Yes, if you vote in the general election for the Green Party or whatever it may be, if you vote for anything other than the Democratic candidate, you're voting to elect a Republican because we have a two-party system in this country, whether we like it or not.
And I think that a tiered voting system just kind of makes more sense.
I agree. I think we absolutely should be doing what San Francisco did and go with instant runoff voting or ranked voting, as it's referred to, where you can choose your principal, hey, I really like this person's policies, but if this person doesn't make the cut, then I'm with this person. In 2000, when we lived in Vermont, knowing that Vermont was going to go for Al Gore, Even Louise, my wife, was unwilling to split her vote. She was unwilling to vote for Ralph Nader, and she voted for Al Gore. I voted for Ralph Nader because I wanted the Green Party to get that 5% so that they would be they would qualify for some federal matching funds, because I thought that they had some really important positions, and I was not pleased with the conservadem direction of the Clinton administration, frankly. But I wasn't horrified by it. It's better than any Republican, but I was not pleased by it. But had I lived in Florida, there's no way I would have voted for Ralph Nader, because that would have been a vote for for George W. Bush. And that's why Bernie Sanders said he's not going to run as a third party candidate. He's not going to do what Jill Stein is doing or what Ralph Nader did, and potentially put a Republican into the White House. Instead, he's going to run in the Democratic primary, and if he loses, he's going to support the Democratic nominee. I congratulate him on that. But yeah, Jill Stein is great, and I'm sure that there's no doubt in my mind that she's going to make it onto this program in the near future. Marty, thanks for the call. Audrey in Richland Park, Illinois. Hey, Audrey, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how are you?
Good. You wanted to talk about Neil McCabe's defense of ending net neutrality?
Yes, I did. I disagree with him totally, and I think his points are moot in that, you know, the Internet belongs to we, the people. We paid for its invention via the Department of Defense.
Right.
We contracted for its creation because we wanted an alternative just in case the enemy cut the phone lines.
Yeah, it was originally DARPA. It was the Department of Defense's communication system. Then they expanded that to universities. I mean, it started out as DARPANET in the 70s. They expanded it to universities in the mid and late 70s and the early 80s. And then it became basically CompuServe and AOL. They figured out how to use that infrastructure, and then HTML got invented. I was in Columbus, Ohio. I used to run a bunch of forums on CompuServe. Me and Sue Nethercutt, who's running our chat room, and Nigel Peacock, who's our webmaster, and Sue wasn't with us, but I think Nigel might have been with me. We were in Columbus, Ohio, at a meeting where CompuServe, they had about 200 of us who were running these forums, and they up on this big electronic board, they demonstrated this new thing called hypertext markup language, HTML. And they showed us, right. Here's a hot link, and here's how it works. And we were all like, well, this is going to be a fad that's going to last a week or two. Yeah, so much for that. Anyhow, your point, Audrey, you think that because the Internet was created by government, that it really should be the property of all of us.
Yes, exactly. I mean, it's ours. You know, I think with part of what's fueling the platforms of people like Mr. McCabe and the Koch brothers and Comcast and AT&T and others of their ilk is this, you know, for the last 30 or 40 years, we've been spoon-fed this hideous notion that government is some distant, dispassionate figure that lords over us and doesn't know what's good for us. No, right. We're the government. We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union. It's spelled out quite
at least that's the theory.
Example.
Yeah,
and that's the thing is, we need to, of course, work, you know, this is planet Earth, so we got to do the actual work and have to do it consistently and constantly because of people who wish to exploit that is so prevalent amongst we the people about how our government works. We have to keep working at making, you know, keep making it a reality once again and then keeping it a reality.
Yeah.
This is our government. The stuff that belongs to government belongs to us.
I'm with you.
And stop this notion.
Yep, I'm with you. I very well said, Audrey. Thank you very much for the call. By the way, I'm seeing Rand Paul's son-in-law was just a fellow by the name of Jesse Benton, who runs the American Liberty PAC, which I think is Rand Paul's pact, was just indicted by a federal prosecutor. This is going to start getting interesting. But I think Rand Paul's candidacy has already imploded. This guy's got no place to go. Robert in Santa Maria, California. Hey, Robert, what's up?
Well, Tom, I've got a lot of good stuff. Either you or Bernie were doing the show when one of you came out with a list of all the things that the Republicans had done and all the stuff that the Democrats had done,
right,
which was a mind blower that should have sank through to quite a few people. And I'm a retired advertising manager. I've done some that and they're still running around the world. And I also know that if Bernie pulls in, if he gets elected to through the
primary,
yeah, call on his independent friends and give them a clear message: I'm going to need you to get rid of these other guys. Don't leave me out there like they've left Democrats before with no support.
Yeah, they really need a 50-state strategy. I wish that Debbie Wasserman Schultz would take some advice from Howard Dean and go back to the 50-state strategy. I mean, Bernie is doing a 50-state strategy. He's you know, drawing 5,000 people in Dallas. You know, he's going to Houston. He'll be in Seattle and Portland this weekend. You know, in fact, in Seattle, he's going to be on the doors open at 6. Program begins at 7. It's Saturday, August 8th. And where's it going to be? At the Alaska Airlines Arena at the Heck Edmondson Pavilion. So anyhow, yeah. Robert, I'm with you. And they need to emphasize the difference between Republicans and Democrats. And Bernie does that great.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archive.
15 minutes before the hour, we'll be back with more of your calls here on Anything Goes Summer. And we're going to check in with the Talk Radio News Service, find out what's going on in the rest of the world. Welcome back. Corky in Hilton, New York. Hey, Corky, what's on your mind today? Thanks for watching Free Speech TV.
Hello, Tom.
Hey,
yeah,
Corky.
You wonder why nobody wants to come on your show.
Well, I'm not sure that they don't want to. They just haven't decided to yet. I'm guessing that
tell you why.
Okay.
Because Norm Chomsky of talk radio, they bury him in the back of every bookstore because they don't want people reading his writings. They don't want people to understand what he's saying. You practice the Desiccated Garda every day on talk radio. You showed me that by having Neil McCabe on. You know what that writing is? I'm sure you've read it.
I'm not.
It says, listen to the dull and the ignorant, for even they have their story to tell.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I remember that was a poster that we all had on our wall in the 60s, the Desiderata, yeah.
Well, they found that on the Sistine Chapel. It was written in 1621.
Huh.
And they are, you practice that right to the T, right down to the last word. They don't want people listening to you. They don't want people to know what you know. And you talk about the educational system. That was intentional. What's the best way to dull down the education of a population? You de-educate the educators.
Right.
They had the problem with Vietnam, because when we came out of the school in the 69, we came out with a real education.
Yeah.
So, and we gave them trouble in Vietnam. We pulled them out of there.
Yep.
And they didn't like the challenge of the population who was intelligent enough to know that they were lying to us.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, this is the basis of my book Screwed, is you know, how the 60s scared the hell out of the conservatives, and they just said, okay, that's it. No more middle class.
So they went in and they de-educated the educators.
Yeah.
And you, how many times did you hear that you had college students coming out of college that couldn't read write at 12th grade level?
Yeah. At the same time that they were complaining about pointy-headed intellectuals in ivory towers.
Yeah.
You know,
well,
either they're too smart or they're too dumb.
when Noam Chomsky, I got his books. I keep a line of his books on my shelf.
Uh-huh.
I'm rereading Keeping the Rabble in Line, because that's pertinent to today.
Yeah.
And what they do is they put you people, like Noam Chomsky, you go into a bookstore, you can't find his books. They got them downstairs in the basement, hidden under the lid of the tank.
Well, part of that, Corky, is that Noam Chomsky writes in a style that is really dense, and I think it's difficult for a lot of people to read. I mean, I really go out of my way in my books to try and write in a very kind of pop culture style, so it's simple and easy to read, at least.
Well, I went out of my way to read his books.
Yeah.
It would take me 6 months to get through a 400-page book.
I know. I had the same problem. Noam Chomsky was relatively unknown until, I think it was Seven Windows Press or whatever it is, started publishing these little booklets of, summaries of his larger writings, little 60- and 80-page booklets. And they started doing that in the 80s, and that, it turned that publisher, it put them on the map, but it also put Noam Chomsky on the map. But I do think that you're right. I think that candidates, we've opened this show to every Republican candidate, to every Democratic candidate, and so far the only one who said, sure, we'll come on, has been Bernie Sanders. And I think people are just, they're a little concerned about public exposure. We'll be back. Thank you, Corky. Minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Luke Vargas with the Talk Radio News Service on the line with us, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and free-don.org. Luke, what's going on in the world? Where are you?
Hey, good afternoon. I'm still in New Hampshire. I just can't bring myself to leave this wonderful state, but I will be moseying on down tomorrow.
I lived there for 5 years. It's a nice state. Now that Bill and Naki Loeb have passed on and it's regained some of its sensibilities. So you're there basically for the Republican debates tomorrow night.
Yes, of course they're not here. But after everything on Monday, decided to hang around.
Oh, that's right. They're in Cleveland, aren't they? Or Cincinnati?
Yes, they are. On Friday, we do have the candidates returning. Jeb Bush will be here. I think it's sort of a quiet weekend. Iowa is really the place to go this time of year. I mean, not for the weather, but at least that's where the candidates want to go. And I think, that's sort of telling that the messages they may be trying to roll out at that debate tomorrow might be more in line with an Iowa audience than they might be with the New Hampshire.
So they'll be talking about corn supports rather than, forestry.
Something along those lines. I do want to jump in because we have seen a few interesting foreign policy related stories today that caught my attention. Of course,
mm-hmm.
President Obama was at American University, not far from you. If you've covered this, just cut me off. But
I haven't.
It is an interesting speech that he gave today. In many ways, much more of an anti-war speech in general than it was precisely about the Iranian nuclear deal. By the numbers, that's not the case. But again, we've heard each of these lines about the Iranian deal so many times over that you look for the parts of the speech that are changing. And it is certainly the president's characterization about what he has called war-hungry politicians in the past who pushed the United States into the 2002, hostilities against Iraq. Quite tellingly, he, pointed out that this vote upcoming in the U.S. Senate is going to be the most critical foreign policy vote since that 2002 authorization of force. Just a reminder, one that your listeners don't need because Bernie Sanders has come on the program so many times, but both Hillary Clinton and Joe Biden voted in favor of the authorization of military force back then, and Bernie Sanders, then serving in the U.S. House of Representatives, did not. So again, sort of an interesting vote to put on the minds of Americans as this Democratic nomination seems to get closer by the day.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. What else is going on in the world?
Keeping the subject on Iran, though not about the nuclear deal, we've heard from Iranian diplomats today, specifically their deputy foreign minister, that the country plans to submit a Syria peace deal to the United Nations some point in the near future. I think this is certainly time to coincide with meetings that are being held in Tehran this week. Iranian-sponsored talks involving Syrian diplomats as well as Russian diplomats. These countries sort of have seen eye to eye to varying degrees on the Syrian crisis in the past few years. And this comes at a time where it does seem like you can score, some plaudits for at least talking about peace. The UN's own Syria mediator last week, and I sat in on a number of his meetings at the UN, was really quite emotionally frustrated by the fact that these talks haven't gone anywhere. He talked about the rise of the Islamic State as sort of having taken everyone's eyes off the prize of peace, and now, you know, talk of anti-terrorism is what everyone wants to be engaging on. So again, interesting that Iran slips in here. We don't know the details of what this proposal would be, though it's likely that it would mirror what Javad Zarif had said last year, which is that you go along 4 points. You start with a ceasefire. Of course, that's really the basis of a peace. No surprise there. Then a national unity government, which for reasons we can understand pretty clearly, is probably one of the more contentious bits of this. Most of the Syrian opposition groups that the UN has been engaging with have said nobody from the Assad government, and particularly Assad himself, can be part of a unity government, but that's not really what unity means. Number three, it would be about constitutional protections for ethnic minorities in the country, and four would lay out a procedure to hold supervised elections. So again, not a whole bunch of surprises here. This is not just an Iranian framework, but it's sort of similar to what the UN has.
Well, it's sort of a civil society framework. But the thing that I think people who are listening or watching need to get is that Iran is uniquely positioned to do this because the Syrian government, the Alawite government of President Bashar al-Assad, is essentially Shiite. I mean, the Alawites are at least not Sunni. And so there's a sort of a natural affiliation there. They have the Iranians have much more influence over Syria than, for example, Saudi Arabia would have.
Yes, and I'll point out last week, Stefan de Mistura, the UN's envoy to Syria, was very clear in saying that Iran needs to be involved in these talks. I'll point out that both in 2012 and 2014, the U.S. very forcefully lobbied the United Nations to exclude Iran from Geneva peace talks. Both of those rounds of talks failed almost before they began, and you could, I think, safely say the exclusion of Iran was to blame for that. So again, it looks like the UN is going to stick up for Iranian inclusion from here on out. I still think the fact that the Iranians say they would turn this over to the UN is an attempt to put it on Ban Ki-moon's doorstep, and it will be his very difficult job of merging whatever consensus Iran can reach with whatever consensus the UN Syria envoy might be able to reach. But again, it is interesting to see that there is a new channel here of diplomacy being pursued in a very high-level fashion.
Yeah. We have about a half a minute left. Luke, what else is going on?
I'll just say very briefly, China's foreign minister said today that land reclamation efforts in the South China Sea are halted. So that's no concession to critics here. All it means is that the dredging is pretty much done and that the construction of military facilities is going to begin. So again, an attempt to sound like they're pacifying things, but they've already done the work they needed to do. That's already so controversial.
And other breaking news, it looks like the wreckage that was found on that island off the coast of India is actually from the Malaysian airline, MH370. And Rand Paul's nephew-in-law just got a federal indictment, and he runs Rand Paul's PAC, Super PAC. That's going to be interesting, right?
I can't wait to read more. You beat me to two different stories.
Okay. Luke Vargas of the Talk Radio News Service. Thanks a lot, Luke.
Thank you. Take care.
Great talking with you. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. The National Nurse Act has been introduced into Congress by Congressman Peter King, the Republican from New York, and Congresswoman Eddie Bernice Johnson, Democrat from Texas, representing the 30th District of Texas. She is the first registered nurse ever to be elected to Congress. And I have to say, Congresswoman Johnson, as the father of a nurse, I am so pleased to have you on our program, Congresswoman Eddie Bernice Johnson. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much, and I'm glad that you had a child, I guess. Is it a woman or a man?
Yeah, it's our oldest daughter, yeah, and she's in fact, she's now a nurse practitioner, I think.
Great.
It's called.
Well, I have great respect for nurses. As you know, they're the most important people in healthcare.
I agree. So tell me about the National Nurse Act that you have introduced into Congress.
Well, you know, as population has grown, and there is no one that gets born and leaves this world without having had to use a nurse or the healthcare system. And with the advent of the Affordable Care Act, more and more people are accessing healthcare. We're trying to get a recognition of the nurse within the Surgeon General's office by simply changing the title to have a chief nursing officer.
Sort of like the
office of the Surgeon General. As you know, the Surgeon General has always been the one who set the tone for health care and the education of health within the nation.
Mm-hmm.
Well, nurses carry all that out.
Right.
And nurses have many roles, from bedside to classrooms to practitioners, and more people are depending on the nurses for their health care. And nursing continues to be the most trusted profession in the nation. So I thought it was time to lift that title of a nurse in that Surgeon General's office at a status where it should be, it is earned, and it has and will have, continue to have, the responsibility for the health care and the educating in the health area for all people throughout the nation.
That's marvelous. That's absolutely marvelous. What do you think the odds that, first of all, I saw that this act has been reintroduced. How often has this been introduced into Congress, and how has it been received in the past?
Well, this is the second term, and what we had to, you know, when you introduce anything, you've got to get all of the stakeholders all over the country to get the information, have their input. So this is our second term, which is not unusual or a major change.
Mm-hmm.
Because all of them have to understand and have input in order to make sure you got a viable package that the profession itself can support. And I think we've done that. We spent the first term getting all the information out, listening to all the stakeholders, and we have revamped the bill and introduced it for this term. We do now have some Senate sponsors, so I think that we are closer to getting something done than what we were the last term.
That is great. That is great. Who would oppose this?
Actually, there's very little opposition inside once we educate. The opposition you have to be concerned about with nurses themselves outside understanding the goals and what is intended.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always felt that every profession needs to understand and be a part of any legislation that affects them. So what we did after we introduced it is circulate it and get input. And at some points there were times when we did have nurses that had some concerns about whether or not this would work. And most especially since we have nurses all through the government, including some within the Surgeon General's office, that were feeling a little threatened that their positions would be replaced. That is not the intent.
Mm.
The intent actually is to put the title of the person at a point where they can have the same profile nationally as the Surgeon General, because people can identify with the nurse long before they identify with the doctor.
Yeah, I agree. And the nurses are the ones who, you know, they're typically your first point of contact. They're very often your last point of contact with the healthcare system. They're the ones who really carry the healthcare system. And in fact, it was our daughter, the nurse, who pitched this story to us. So I'm really, really glad that you were able to come on. And I want to salute you, Congresswoman Johnson, for the great work that you're doing and for carrying this forward.
Well, thank you very much, and I appreciate that because, you know, it is a very important profession, but it is being taken for granted, and it's rare that anyone wants to hear anything about nurses. They just know and feel certain they'll be there when they need them.
Yeah. Well, anything.
We have a big shortage of nurses, so we really want to continue to encourage young people to think about that profession because it's one of the most important professions.
I absolutely agree. And anything that we can do on this program to help move this along, I'm assuming that the call for action right now would be for people to call their member of the House of Representatives. The switchboard number for Congress is 202-225-3121. And if you don't know who represents you, you can just give the operator your zip code and they will connect you to your U.S. representative, your member of the House of Representatives, and ask them to support the National Nurse Act. Is that the way to do it, Congressman Johnson?
That is great, and I really appreciate that. And you'd be surprised how many more. But thank you very much. That's exactly what we need.
Okay, great. Congresswoman Eddie Bernice Johnson, so brilliantly representing the 30th District of Texas, thank you so much for dropping by today.
Thank you very much.
Great talking with you. This is like, you know, it's like talking about working people. You know, the nurses are where the rubber hits the road, as it were. So, anyhow, it's Anything Goes Summer. Liz in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Hey, Liz, thanks for listening and tuning in. What's up? Liz? Uh-oh. Liz, call me back if you can't hear me. I'm sorry. It doesn't seem to be working. Paul in South Lyon, Michigan. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Yeah, thanks, Tom. Yeah, I want to say Hillary Clinton is not too close to the banksters. The banksters and other billionaires are spending hundreds of millions of dollars to defeat her, and you're helping them. Was Hillary a corporatist when she proposed universal health care in the 90s, or when she supports strong bank regulation and raising the minimum wage, or when she had the 10th best progressive record in the Senate? And she's proposing a large tax increase on billionaires in capital gains. Is that because she's too close to Wall Street? No.
All good reasons to support Hillary Clinton, Paul.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, but
I am not opposed to Hillary Clinton. I totally support her candidacy, and if she is the nominee for this party, I will work my ass off to get her elected. I've been unambiguous about that, and I don't think that I'm doing anything that would help her be defeated or whatever the phrase was that you used.
Let me get to my last point. There is a few honest bankers who've given her some chump change. And you and Papantonio are exaggerating that into, oh, she's controlled by the banks.
I've never said that Hillary was controlled by the banks.
Well, you agreed with the caller who said that like a half an hour ago.
No, what that caller said was that Hillary Clinton is perceived as being too close to the banks, if I remember correctly. And what I said was that the Democratic Party is taking too much money from the banks, and frankly, the Republican Party, too. But the banksters, I mean, there's a piece in the New York Times today, Paul, that you should read about how the banksters in New York are given identical money to Jeb Bush and Hillary Clinton because they figure, you know, whoever wins, we can work with them. I doubt that Rand Paul or Bernie Sanders are getting that money.
It was where?
Pardon? It's in the New York Times.
Oh, the New York Times. The billionaire-owned New York Times. Okay.
Well, the New York Times, obviously, you know, yeah, they have... I would probably agree with you, Paul, that the New York Times seems to have an anti-Hillary agenda. Their most recent coverage of her has been deplorable, absolutely deplorable. Paul, thanks for the call. We'll be back. It's 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You know, we've got to make sure that we have a Democrat in the White House in 2016. There's just no other way to say it. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Howard, watching Free Speech TV in Coriopolis, Pennsylvania. Hey, Howard, what's up? Howard? Oh, no, we're having another Comcast moment here. Let's try Randy, watching Free Speech TV in Arroyo Grande, California. Randy, can you hear me?
I can, Mr. Hartman. How are you?
I am well. How are you?
Great. Good, thanks. I heard Amy Goodman say on Democracy Now! Yesterday that Comcast, I guess, has just opened up a huge lawsuit against the FCC, you know, about net neutrality. What a perfect timing to get rid of Ed Schultz.
Right. You will not hear that reported on MSNBC.
His own company.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Right. Yeah. Like everything that you always mention, there's so many things that we don't hear, and I'm spreading the word to everybody. People probably think, you know, I'm a little nuts, but I'm telling everybody about you and Free Speech TV and trying to, you know, tell people to vote and all that. Yeah.
Yeah. The big telco companies are too big. You know, we've got too big to fail banks. We've got too big to to exist telco companies and now reaching out and owning television networks. That was a merger that never should have been allowed to happen. Randy, thanks a lot for the call. I'm totally with you. Dale in Boulevard, California. Hey, Dale, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Hey, I was listening to your debate about net neutrality and this other comments here. And, like, for example, I own 6 acres out in eastern San Diego County, and I have on my deed utility and road easements. And I have 2 big power poles, and they have telephone lines strung underneath them.
Mm-hmm.
And I still own the land underneath the pole, but I can't do nothing to the pole
right.
The phone lines.
Right.
And recently AT&T has converted those phone lines to fiber optics so they can provide, internet service here.
Right.
But it seems to me that along with Comcast and AT&T, if they don't want, those were common carrier easements. Now, if they don't want to be common carriers, then I think they're clearly in violation of the terms of the easements that I gave them to put those poles on my property.
Wow, you would be the perfect litigant. If they blow up net neutrality, you're the kind of guy who could take a case to the Supreme Court and back it up.
Well, you know, there's actually millions of us like that across the country.
Yeah.
Any place there is a public easement for a common carrier lines that they want to use, for a private corporation or business.
Have you read your deed recently? Does it actually use the phrase common carrier?
No, what it says is utility and road easements.
I see.
But they have always been proper. Now, I can't. There used to be an old hardwired copper for the phone lines.
Right.
And they recently upgraded them.
Yeah.
But it doesn't. It's always been, those have both been common carrier purposes.
Right, right.
So I'll have to go back. I don't think it says anything about.
Yeah, it would be interesting. It would be interesting to know, but you're probably right. It doesn't. I think the assumption, pre Reagan era, the vast majority of electricity in this country was produced by locally owned utilities. You had an AT&T monopoly on telephones, but it was heavily regulated as a common carrier. So, be interesting to see. Be interesting to see. Dale, thanks a lot for the call, and your point is spot on. You are absolutely right. Thank you. We'll be right back. It's 20 minutes past the hour. Past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. It's Anything Goes Summer, although we've got a bunch of topics on the table here. And this is an interesting piece. Rick Newman with Yahoo Finance 3 hours ago published a piece called How to Get Rich by Running for President. And it starts out talking about Mike Huckabee. It's a great year. 2008 was a great year for Huckabee. The Arkansas governor bailed out of the presidential race in March after losing steam in the primaries, but by simply running for president, he became a celebrity, which helped him build a devoted following among evangelicals. Huckabee has since converted the renown that comes with running for national office into a business enterprise that has made him wealthy with a palatial beachfront home, access to private jets, and other perks of the top 1%. I'm telling you, this is why, these obscure candidates run for president. Because it's a great way, it's a scam. It's a great way of making money. Here's another, a couple of other stories here, just news stories I want to share with you, and then I'll pick up your phone calls. In North Carolina, this Don Viejo posting over on democraticunderground.com, although it's a link off rawstoryactually.com, the North Carolina County Commissioner storms out of a meeting. This is the Lincoln County Board of Commissioners. This is North Carolina. They had always opened their meetings with a prayer, and it was always a Christian prayer. And these are the guys, keep in mind, these are the people who say, oh, America was founded on religion, and, we need to have prayer in school. We need to have prayer in our public meetings. To avoid being hassled, they said, okay, we will open this prayer up to people who are not Christians to make the prayers. Now, the Satanic Temple has not applied, to the best of my knowledge, yet, although they will probably get around to it. They have been flipping out people all over the country. But a Muslim, a local Muslim, there's no doubt a mosque in the area, a local Muslim minister, an imam, did the opening prayer. And as he's doing the opening prayer, this fool, Carol Mitchum, it's Carol with two R's, like Carol O'Connor was, the guy who played Archie Bunker. On Monday, Commission Chairman Carol Mitchum, who had previously announced he ain't going to bow to minorities and they ain't going to have no new religion or pray to Allah at board meetings, held true to his word and walked out of the first person on the first person to address the North Carolina government meeting with a Muslim prayer, the Lincoln Times News reports. Dustin Bartow of the Foothills Interfaith Assembly says this is really upsetting. So by the end of the meeting, all prayer was banned at board meetings and will be replaced with a moment of silence. Oh, man. It's a sad commentary on Islamophobia, first of all. And I think an important commentary on Islamophobia. But secondly, it points out the hypocrisy of these guys. They're not in favor of prayer. They don't think that prayer somehow helps things. They're in favor of Christian prayer because they want to proselytize on behalf of their particular religion. Jesse Benton is the nephew-in-law of Rand Paul. And back in 2012, he was working on, and he's running the Rand Paul Super PAC. But back in 2012, he was running the Ron Paul campaign for president. And was apparently involved in an endorsement for pay scheme in 2012, where he was allegedly bribing local Republicans and particularly high profile Republicans in Iowa to come out and endorse Ron Paul. And the federal government has now indicted him for this. Assistant Attorney General Leslie Caldwell said in a statement about the indictment, quote, federal campaign finance laws are intended to ensure the integrity and transparency of the federal election process. When political operatives make under-the-table payments to buy an elected official's political support, it undermines public confidence in our entire political system. Wow. You know, you would think that a couple of billionaire brothers who inherited an oil fortune from daddy saying that they're going to throw $900 million into the political system would also, quote, undermine public confidence in our entire political system. But the Supreme Court has said, oh, they can do that. So you can't buy one politician in Iowa to make an endorsement for Ron Paul. That will get you sent to prison. But you can buy Scott Walker and make him president of the United States, make him governor of Minnesota. No problem with that. Tell me what's wrong with this picture. Ben in Miami. Hey, Ben, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. I want to talk about net neutrality. I have a few points to make. Quick answer to your other caller from a few minutes ago, the one that had the easements on his property. Verizon actually wanted to have his cake and eat it, too, in that regard. You know, telephone service was always regulated under Title II, and their fiber optic service, Fios, was regulated under Title I, and when the debate came up last year, they were saying it should be kept that way. However, they've been using, when deploying the fiber out to everyone's home, they've been using Title II to get the easements.
So they're claiming that they're a common carrier in order to force people to carry their wires over private property. But then when it comes to being regulated, they say, oh, we're not Title II, we're Title I. We should be able to listen in on what people are doing on the Internet and charge them different prices for different websites.
That's exactly what they were doing.
Amazing.
So the points I wanted to bring up, though, were this. First one is about the illegal activities that your guests brought
up. Real quick, Ben. We got less than a minute here.
I'll make it real quick. So there's actually two laws that provide immunity for our ISPs. One is the Communications Decency Act.
Mm-hmm.
So if someone posts something illegal online, the poster is responsible, not the ISP or the service that it was posted on. And the other is the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which protects the ISPs under safe harbor. As long as if someone has a copyright violation, they report it to the ICP. The ICP just has to remove it.
Right.
They have no liability though.
So they have a very fairly broad immunity as long as. But I think if they start getting in the weeds and slicing and dicing websites, it's going to increase their liability. Ben, thank you for
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
I can't make that as a categorical assertion, but it seems logical. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person, or Hobby Lobby for that matter, and we dare to say, no, it's a corporation. Come on, it's a completely different thing. It doesn't live, it doesn't breathe. Why are you trying to give it human rights? It's constitutional. It's crazy. Okay, a little bit of geeky science, and then we'll get back to your phone calls here on Anything Goes Summer. This was published in the New York Times today in the blogs on wellness. It's by Nicholas Bacalar, and the headline pretty much summarizes it, Eating Spicy Food Linked to a Longer Life. I've got to get Louise to read this. I love spicy food. I just love spicy food, always have. And Louise really loves bland food. And so, you know, in some ways it's sort of like Jack Spratt and his wife. You know, between the two of us, we can take a meal apart and eat everything, but... it would be really cool if she would get excited about spicy stuff. So eating spicy food is associated with a reduced risk for death. An analysis of dietary data on more than 485,000 people found. This was a large Chinese health study done over a four-year period, 2004 to 2008. The researchers followed these folks for an average of more than 7 years, and they recorded 20,224 deaths. And after controlling for family medical history, age, education, diabetes, smoking, and many other variables, the researchers found that compared with eating hot food, mainly chili peppers, less than once a week, having it once or twice a week resulted in a 10% overall reduced risk of death. Consuming spicy foods 6 to 7 times a week reduced the risk by 14%. Wow. Risks of ischemic heart disease, respiratory diseases, and cancers were all lower in hot food eaters. The authors drew no conclusions about cause and effect, but they noted that capsaicin, the main ingredient in chili peppers, had been found in other studies to have antioxidant and anti-inflammatory effects. I'll bet it goes a step beyond that. Because a lot of hot foods are actually curries, and curries don't just contain hot peppers. They also contain turmeric, which is an insanely potent and effective anti-inflammatory agent. In fact, there's research linking people who take turmeric with, reduced risk of dementia and Alzheimer's. For that and other reasons, I take 3 capsules of just raw turmeric every day. Then there's other things that are in curries. Bioprene is another one. Bioprene is the biologically active ingredient that's in black pepper, and black pepper is typically added to curries. And then, of course, you got the hot peppers. You got the capsicum, or capsaicin, or however you say it. And there are other ingredients as well. And many times these things work synergistically. You know, it's like if you have cooked asparagus. Excuse me, broccoli. If you have cooked broccoli, broccoli has 2 different compounds in it, a base compound and an enzyme that converts that base compound into a really potent anti-cancer agent. But if you cook it, it destroys the enzyme, so you don't get the anti-cancer effects from eating cooked broccoli. However, the same enzyme exists in mustard seeds. So if you take ground up mustard, not cooked, but just powdered ground mustard, and you add it to your steamed broccoli, boom, you're back to having an anti-cancer cocktail. It's great stuff. So, okay, enough for our geeky science. Liz in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Hey, Liz, you wanted to talk about Bernie and Trump?
Oh, yeah, I was gonna, but, dear Lord, you hung up, or I don't know what happened, but am I on?
You are. You're on the air, Liz. What's up?
Like I said, Jesus. I was always wondering why people would call the show, reading something, because you're a DJ, right?
Yeah, what, Liz, what's your point?
Well, I was on hold that long. I didn't expect to be on hold that long.
Oh, okay. Liz, I'm very sorry that you were on hold for 21 minutes. It happens. Next time you call, well, I can't make any guarantees. Thank you for calling. Martin in West Palm Beach, Florida. Hey, Martin, what's up?
Yeah, hi. Going right up the Florida coast, Miami for a long
time. Yeah, and you've been on hold for 57 minutes. I appreciate that, Martin. Thank you.
We're very popular here in Florida. Well, I'm going to out myself here as being one of those nasty people that voted for Nader against Gore, and I'm going to give you my reasoning. Many of us down here were active in the Democratic Party, have been for many years, also became a member of the Green Party briefly, no longer. And what we were so furious about, so many of us were...
Martin, if I can interrupt you just for a second, your phone is badly distorted. Are we talking on speaker?
Yeah, okay, take that off.
Can you take it off speaker,
now?
Please? I think, then I'll be able to understand.
Can you hear me better now?
Yes, now I can understand what you're saying. Let's start over.
Okay, well... I was one of those nasty people that voted for Nader here in Florida, and I want to explain why.
Okay, in 2000.
Many of us were very, very disappointed when Gore appointed, when he had Lieberman as vice president.
Yeah.
We thought that was the final straw. He sort of rubbed it in our faces at that point. That was the time, you recall, Paul Wellstone. Paul Wellstone was the Bernie Sanders of his day before he died in a plane crash.
Correct.
And the Wellstone people that many of us were, he represented the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party. And we thought Gore should do that. Look, the vice presidential spot is kind of a ceremonial thing anyway. So we thought if he didn't even have the power to work to have his own vice president, then he had nothing. He was just completely a captor to all the rest of the same interests everybody else had. So we forgot about it. Now, I'm so nervous about if Hillary wins and does not ask Bernie to be vice president, I'm seriously considering to do the same thing and vote for Jill Stein. I don't want to.
Yeah.
It would drive me crazy to do so. I am a lesser evil voter. And I believe in voting for the lesser evil if you have to. But this is like throwing it in our face all the time. Yeah. I mean, it's one thing. They know that Bernie Sanders is going to bring out the voters. They know that.
Martin, hang on just a second. Let's slow down just a little bit. Number one. Sure. If Hillary Clinton is the nominee, there's no way she's going to have Bernie as her vice presidential candidate because you would have two people who are basically in their 70s as they go into the White House. And that is a ticket that you're going to have that's going to be a challenge. Either Hillary or Bernie, if one of them is the nominee, they need to pick somebody who is at least under 65 and ideally in the neighborhood of 50 to 60. To be their running mate.
I may respectfully disagree. I think that is completely irrelevant. I don't think people would give a damn about that.
Well, I hope you're right.
And statistically nowadays, but I would say that we need to have somebody to get the vote out. When Democrats are displeased with the primary nominee, they stay home.
Yeah.
They don't vote. And he's the guy to get the vote out for.
Oh, yeah. But Elizabeth Warren could do the same thing, although then you'd have two women on a ticket.
I've already addressed that with other people. Two women, that's a dead deal to begin with.
Okay. See, I think, two people who are over 70 is a dead deal. You think two women is a dead deal. We're probably both right. I don't know, but let me go to your point that you would vote for Jill Stein if Hillary was the nominee. That's a horrible mistake, Martin. That's like voting for Scott Walker.
Well, I'm just saying, in a sense, it's like being in slavery. At some point, you have to say, I don't choose to be a slave.
Well, this isn't slavery. Come on, that's a terrible analogy. Slavery that's like a Holocaust analogy. Yeah, slavery was a god-awful institution. We're not experiencing slavery here. We're experiencing narrowing of choices as a consequence of Supreme Court decisions and the fact that we have first-past-the-post-winner-take-all elections, which basically force a two-party system on a country. But that's not slavery. That's just the system.
Well, let me make it a little easier for you to understand. It's like wanting to be the house person instead of the field person, because you're going to just sidle up to the owners, and there was always a tension between the two types of slaves. And so in a way, they're asking us to be a house slave and asking us to enjoy our position.
I don't, Martin, no, come on. I think the choices are quite clear.
I'm not in favor of the lesser evil issues. I mean, I was furious when I found out that Nader, I mean, Bernie Sanders did it the right way. He went, he was in Vermont, he became the senator, and he did his work, he was there, and he's running for president. Ralph Nader, whom I voted for back then, when I found out that he was from Connecticut, and he could have run against Lieberman.
Right.
He could have been the guy to, instead of Wofford or whatever his name was that was there, the Republican who was actually more liberal than Lieberman. I was curious to find out that Ralph did not do put in his time the proper way. He could have been the senator from Connecticut.
Yeah.
And he didn't choose to do that. He chose to go right to the top of the ticket.
Well, Ralph always wanted. Ralph Nader has always, his entire life, been an outsider, and he was not willing to become an insider in order to gain political power. Bernie is willing to be an insider, or at least, be inside the beast, as it were, inside the machine, in order to change the machine. I think that that's a noble thing. But if Bernie doesn't make it, Hillary Clinton will still make a decent and maybe a damn good president. In fact, I think she has the potential to be the next FDR. Bernie is the next FDR, as far as I can tell. But the times drive the people, not the other way around. Martin, we got to be really careful that we're not electing Scott Walker. Thank you for the call. But, Scott Walker as president would just be so damaging to this country.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
15 minutes before the hour, back with your calls on Anything Goes Summer right here on the Tom Hartman program. Welcome back. Prakash, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV in Coalinga, California. Am I pronouncing your name right?
Oh, you got it perfectly fine, sir. Great. I firstly wish to thank you for getting Mr. Bernie Sanders on board.
Oh, my pleasure.
And I think you are the one who were responsible to a large extent of getting him on board.
Oh, I think he did it himself. We've just been, peripherally part of that. But, thank you for the acknowledgement.
I need to thank someone, and I watch your show. I've always watched your show for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And I am, of course, a Democrat. I don't hate anyone. From our last conversation, I love them all.
Yeah.
But I just beg to think a little differently than the rest of the world, I guess. And my point is that they want me to vote for Hillary Clinton. I don't much care for her. I like her. But I sent in, I don't know how to send any money to Mr. Sanders. So I sent in my donation to the DNC, and I wrote down Bernie Sanders' name next to it.
Mm-hmm.
And on the bottom, I wrote down Bernie for president, and of course, I signed my check and I sent it. I hope it gets there to him.
That's great. That's great.
I'm just trying to do small things in my small way.
Prakash, just FYI, both Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, and presumably all the other Democratic nominees, if you just go to their main website, they've got a big donate button there, and it's real easy. It'd be BernieSanders.com or HillaryClinton.com or presumably MartinO'Malley.com, JimWebb.com, LincolnChafee.com. So that's how to do it. You wanted to, you were going to tell us about spicy food?
You might be aware I'm from India, and I was watching this great show on Alzheimer's disease, and they showed that eating curry, which is exactly what you were talking about, does seem to prevent the onset of Alzheimer's disease, and they said that that's why a lot of people in India have the least amount of Alzheimer's disease compared to anywhere else in the world.
Yeah, that's where they did the original epidemiology. I learned about this on Dr. Greger's site, nutritionfacts.org. He's got a little 3 or 4 minute video about curcumin is the active ingredient in turmeric, about turmeric and curry and Alzheimer's. I thought it was fascinating.
Yes, and let me also mention to you that my mother's grand uncle, he lived to be way more than 100. I think he died at 120. And he told me one thing, and that was that if you eat anything with ginger, garlic, and onion, whatever you eat, he said that you'll live forever. And this guy, at that old age, used to ride a bike, and I'm sure exercise had something to do with it. But he lived forever. When I left India and I came to this country, he was way over 100.
Wow.
He was going strong.
Yeah. Garlic, onions, and what? Oh, and ginger.
Garlic, onion, and ginger.
Yeah. I've been drinking ginger tea over at the TV studio. They just got some. I love all three of those things. I love raw garlic. I love cooked garlic. I love onions, too.
Yes.
Yeah,
and
so
I'm also very much like you. I became a vegetarian. I used to eat meat when I first came over here. And then I found out all the nasty stuff that they put into the meat, because I came here as a research scientist at the University of Connecticut. And then I found out all the steroids, the antibiotics and stuff that they put into the meat.
Oh, it's,
and
it's
one by
terrible.
One I started giving up meat. And then the last thing I used to eat was chicken, till I found out on National Geographic how they slaughtered the chicken, and I saw nothing but chicken.
Good on you, Prakash. We're out of time, but thank you so much for the call, and thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We'll be right back. Ten minutes before the hour, Tom Harmon here with you, and Liz in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Hey, Liz, what's up?
Hey, Tom. All Bernie was saying earlier was that everyone should have a fair shot at it, and it shouldn't just be rich people.
Yeah. Well, I absolutely agree, and that it's not really a democracy when 60 billionaires, combined, raise hundreds of millions of dollars, or when 2 billionaires say that they're going to spend almost $1 billion to buy an election. It's not democracy, and he's right. Liz, thank you for the call. Paul in Woodinville, Washington. Hey, Paul, what's on your mind today?
Tom, I'm trying to figure out how what Planned Parenthood is doing with fetal tissue recovery is different than regular old organ donation, like the way Dick Cheney got his heart.
It's not different. It's the same
not
thing.
At all. I mean,
he uses the same systems. It's covered by the same laws.
And so what is being alleged? I mean, so we have, I guess they try to use this edited video to say that, oh, this surgeon is, the Planned Parenthood surgeon is, well, if I can just get the fetus like this. Well, guess what? An organ donor, if you have it on the back of your license or identification, the body of a person who is an organ donor will be treated differently than someone who's not.
Right.
And then a surgeon has to come in and remove the heart, and that surgeon gets paid a lot of money, and then that heart has to be put into special environment so that it will be viable. And so I don't understand any of – so if they're just outraged about abortion, fine. Let them be outraged.
Well, what they're trying to do is gross us out, Paul. This is their strategy in its simplest way, is, you know, just gross out people to the point that they're like, ooh. And you know, it's apparently working with the Republicans.
Well, I have to tell you, this is, when I was teaching biology, I did a unit on microscopes, and I was trying to get a sample of my blood onto a slide, and then I think at lunchtime we were laughing about some ketchup got out onto my finger from my hamburger, and I put that on a slide, and I put that in there, and the kids looked through it and they went, "Ooh, that looks like an abortion." And I said, "How do you know that?" I said, "You know what that is? It's ketchup."
Right.
But see, they'd already been brainwashed.
Right. Right.
It's
ridiculous. Yeah, it really is. It's really sad and unfortunate, and it's part of an orchestrated campaign, in my opinion. And it's not just about abortion. It's about birth control. It's about access to reproductive health services. It's about access to cancer screenings for low income women. This is the vast majority of what Planned Parenthood does.
And,
it's part
and
of a campaign to
women.
Disempower women.
Right, and so with a woman running for president, I cannot see. If this makes a difference, how anybody who is a woman would resonate with any of this crap.
Yeah, I agree. And Hillary Clinton, and God bless her for it, has been calling this out rather loudly over the last 24 hours. And, you know, it's the perfect issue. It's the perfect issue for her as a woman. Paul, thank you for the call. It's always great to hear from you. Glenn in Mount Pleasant, Utah. Hey, Glenn, what's up?
Well, I got one question answered with that gentleman from India about where to donate to Bernie. My other question was, I'm kind of concerned, does Bernie have any large financial backers? Because obviously it's about money now, you know, I mean, right. Everybody else. And I think he'd be an excellent candidate, but I'm just concerned about if he can actually stay in the competition.
I can offer you my speculation. I have no inside information on this at all, but I do know that there are some very wealthy people who are just absolutely in love with Bernie Sanders and can write, you know, large checks. And I would be frankly surprised if, as the primary process goes on and Bernie's candidacy becomes, you know, one of two things is going to happen. Either Bernie's candidacy is going to get stronger and stronger, and he's going to be seen as a serious challenger, not only to Hillary Clinton, but to all the Republicans. Or his candidacy is going to implode. If it implodes, it'll probably be sort of like the Dean scream. In other words, the media will take him down. And they've already started that. I mean, Chris Matthews started that charge last week on MSNBC. But, you know, I'm not so sure that the media can take Bernie down, because I think he's built a strong enough base. So my belief is, and again, I have no evidence of this and no inside knowledge of this, but my belief is that if Bernie makes it through that time period, and it's probably going to be the next month or so, and is clearly a solid, viable candidate, is giving Hillary a run for her money and is giving the Republicans a run for their money. And it's got to be both. I mean, you know, Democrats want to elect somebody who can actually become president. If he's successful in doing that, and I think there's a very good chance he will be, that he cannot control other people starting super PACs that might work to his benefit. He has zero ability to stop people from doing that. And if they do it, they would not interact with him or his campaign, and he would, and in fact, we all know he would refuse to even talk to them. It's not only the law, but it's also Bernie's morality. But I would be astonished. Yeah. I would be absolutely astonished if you know, some of the genuinely wealthy people, you know, who's Tom Steyer, the billionaire, who's said he's going to spend $50 million to elect environmental candidates. You know, I don't know Tom Steyer. I've never met him. But I'm not even sure I've ever even talked to him. I might have run into him at a Democracy Alliance meeting or something, but I don't think so. But I would be astonished if people like him or of his caliber didn't say, okay, we're going to start a super PAC, and you know they might not call it the Bernie PAC, but we're on with the issues that Senator Sanders is on, and they'd run issue ads that would basically backstop Bernie. So
yeah, I mean that's my only concern, because you know I like all of his ideas and everything else. I think he'd be an excellent candidate. I think he really represents the people.
There are a lot of good, wealthy people in this country who I think would use the system to support Bernie, and certainly right now are using the system to support Hillary Clinton. And God bless them for it. There's a couple of PACs out there that are already supporting Hillary Clinton. I think Paul Begala is running one of them. There's another one. I'm forgetting who's running that. But, you know, at a certain point, you've got to say, okay, this is the system that we live in. We have to operate within that system. Glenn, thank you for the call. I mean, Bernie has essentially already said he will operate within the system by running as a Democrat. So, you know, we'll just see where it all goes. I would not worry about that. I think that'll take care of itself. Thanks so much for being with us today. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It requires you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.